Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling in association with Alaka Bicycle Insurance. I'm Graham Wilgos. Brad, welcome back to your own show, off for a week.
No, it's good to be back, isn't it?
It's great to be back. A lot has happened, and to help us catch up with everything that's happened, would you like to introduce our guest?
Yeah, the man himself, the King Kelly, former welter winner.
1988 welter winner, Sean. Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show.
Yes, good to be back and good to have racing still going on.
Isn't it just? So Brad, the last time we spoke, Teo Geoghegan-Hart had just won the Giro d'Italia on the final day in the time trial. Now we've got a little bit more perspective on it. I mean, he wrote a race diary for the Telegraph that was published today saying how it's only now he's back home in the UK that what he has achieved is starting to sink in.
Yeah.
Can you appreciate that? The fact that you know, it's only been a week for him, but... It's going to take a lot longer than a week for it to start, for it to sink in properly, but...
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever sink in for him because you always expect that thing to happen to other people. And because he's such a fan of the sport and such an idol, idolises the people that went before him, he probably doesn't appreciate... There's a contradiction. He doesn't appreciate his own talent and that he was capable as much as he wanted to. But he would always look up to other riders and, you know... He put a picture on Instagram the other day when there was a team presentation, stood next to the trophy. And now he's got the trophy in the boot of his car. Because it won't change him. And I think that will probably make him a better rider down the line, is that it's not a lack of belief. Because he applies himself, he's confident. The way he rode that last week, he was so confident in what he was doing. He's confident in his ability, but he won't get above himself and it won't change him. But... in terms of sinking in, I think it'd be hard for him to get his head around the fact that he's won the Giro d'Italia. It's one of those things that, even for me, winning the Tour de France, you know, you get used to people saying it, but the magnitude of the thing, watching the Tour on the telly and watching Sean over the years, you know, in Green and Indurain and people like that I looked up to, Bugno, Chiappucci, you never imagined that one day you'd be doing the same as them. Because I'm still a fan of the sport, you know.
Sean, it can take you a little while to get your head around, hey, winning a Grand Tour.
Well, it can, depending on the circumstances. And as Brad said, for Teo, he went to the Giro, of course, to be the domestique for Geraint Thomas. And then, of course, yeah, we know what happened. Geraint crashed out and slowly he came back into the into his possibility of winning it. And as the race went on, he was getting better. So... you know, it takes a long time to get your mind around that. And of course, you know, when you finish the race, there's so much goes on afterwards. You're so inundated with people wanting to do interviews, radio, TV, written press and all of that. You know, you're in that bubble and you know, it just goes on for a number of weeks afterwards. But slowly through the winter time, you know, he will start thinking back about the stages and, you know, he will be thinking about the days where he had the really good rides and how it all went. And slowly you start to, you know, realise that you have won it. And, then it comes to a point that, yeah, you have to be able to, you know, control all that as well and not get carried away, because we know Teo, he's very down to earth. He's a straight out talker. He doesn't talk any B after the finish when he's interviewed. And, sometimes it can change, guys. We've seen guys very solid looking, but it can change them a bit. But I think with Teo, he'll be solid. And, get more confidence out of this. Now, you know, he has won it and he just get confidence from that. And the age he is as well, I think he will go on and he should be able to, you know, repeat some great performances. One thing I was thinking about during the Giro when he was coming up there, I remember last year in the Vuelta, he was attacking at times when it was a bit crazy. And I was asking myself, what's he doing? Attacking out of a bunch when there's a team riding. But, you know, all of those things, I suppose, you learn your trade by doing those things and maybe calling the mistakes if you like to do that. But, now it's a totally different situation for him going forward. And he knows he can handle a 3-week tour with that pressure. because there is pressure there. When you get into the situation of trying to win the race, then goes down to the time trial, all of that is something new. And he's proved himself he can handle all of that.
Sean, you know, when you won the Vuelta, obviously you never won another Grand Tour after that. And was there another one that you look back and you think, like, I should have won that? And was there a mistake, or was there something that happened in the lead up in terms of illness and stuff? Or so when you won that Vuelta, did you think, like, I can go on now and win another Grand Tour? Or was that your opportunity to win that Vuelta? And because when I look back at mine, I think 2014, because I didn't get selected for the Tour, I just won the Tour of California. I would have been working for Froome, but he crashed out on the cobbles, and then Contador crashed out. And I kind of think if I'd have had a straight run and been there, I reckon I could have beat Nibali with a 55k time trial, and I could have probably won a second Tour. I would have was physically capable of winning another Tour without a crash. And that's the one I look back on and think that would have been an opportunity to win a second Tour. But with you, do you ever think after that there was one Tour or one Vuelta where, or do you just see that one had specific circumstances that you managed to win it?
Well, I think in the lead up, the number of years before that, 88 Vuelta victory, 87, I was getting close to winning it. And with a number of days to go, I got a saddle boil and I had to pull out of the race with the race leader jersey on my shoulders. But going back from that, you know, I was always going into the Tour of France with the hope of winning it or getting on the podium. And my DS, John de Garibaldi, who had a big influence on my career, was telling me, yes, you know, you can get on the podium in the Tour of France and possibly win it.
Because the year you broke your collarbone, you were in really good shape, weren't you?
Yes, there was times I was in good shape. But then when I won the Vuelta, of course, I was in excellent shape. And that year I was thinking, hopefully I could, you know, possibly win a Tour or get onto the podium of the Tour.
Because you'd just done Roubaix before as well, wouldn't you?
Yes, well, I had done the Classic campaign, and I think, that was probably having an effect on my performances in the Tour of France, because doing the Classics, then doing immediately after the Classics, Vuelta and onto the Tour, probably a bit too much of a heavy programme. But when you win a big Tour, it does give you that confidence. Even though I was trying for many years before, finishing, you know, fourth, fifth in the Tour of France, when you crack it, a big 3-week one, then you think to yourself and you have the confidence that you can win another one.
Did you ever feel there was a Tour you could have won or should have won had a certain thing happened or a day happened? You got fourth one, didn't you?
Yes, I got fourth. No, I think at the end, when I look back at all the Tours, I was never really in a position to win one. I think in hindsight, if I had maybe an easier program in the earlier part of my season, in my good years, I would have been on the podium. But to win a Tour of France, I don't think I could ever have done it.
A man who has rediscovered his confidence, it seems, after it surely taking quite a knock, Primoz Roglic. Just bring us up to speed, Sean. You've been on comms for the Vuelta all week for Eurosport. It's largely been a brutal week in the mountains, I think it's fair to say. Roglic, he's completed his hat-trick of stage victories already, two more this week, adding to his victory from stage one.
Well, it's been a real difficult Vuelta. The first week was a brutal one, and he, you know, hit the ground running, as they say, and winning three stages in, you know, the first week or 10 days. And we were asking ourselves in the beginning of the Vuelta, you know, would he start suffering, because he's been going so well right from the moment the season restarted in the beginning of August. He was in top shape. And we know in the Tour of France the way he performed. And coming into this Vuelta, I was wondering, would he be able to keep, you know, that high level of performances going? But he certainly have. And not only in the earlier days, like in the end of the second week, he's still looking so, so good. And it looks like, yes, that he's not suffering from tiredness, fatigue at all.
Brad, his stage 10 win, we saw what would have been the 3-second rule that we'd usually see for a bunch sprint was changed to a 1-second rule. That we see for the mountains, for the time gaps, which obviously led to a rider protest on stage 11.
Absolutely.
This seemed unusual for me to see some solidarity in the peloton for a change with the riders and actually all coming together to protest at the race changing the rules after the event. And my sympathy here is with the riders.
Yeah, but why would they change it without discussion of the riders? If it came from the riders in the first place, but to change it after the race, you know, this race could come down to 2 or 3 seconds, and to change it to after the race, for, you know, when it's been the way it has been since whenever, to change that ruling, it just makes you scratch your head that where they come up with this stuff, really, without any consultation of the riders. And yet other things that are far more important, you never see them, you know? We haven't seen Le Partillon since July. You know, at least for Pat McQuaid, when he was... you'd see him at all the races. He'd be there chatting to the riders. There was some sort of connection between the UCI and the riders, because ultimately the UCI wouldn't have a job if the riders refused to race.
Yeah.
And they're in a privileged position as the governing body of this sport, and they don't do a good job, you know? And I think... if there was strong reasoning behind it, a consultation of the riders just to show respect and the teams would have gone a long way. But to change it after the race, halfway through a race, it's that way they let the sport down. So, you know, good on the riders for doing that.
I mean, it was enough to put Roglic back into red, Sean, this week. But then there was some confusion on stage 11 as to who was actually leading the race. Where do you stand on this one?
Well, as Bradley said, I think the commissars, they seem to make a very late call on that 3 second to a 1 second.
And what was the reasoning for it?
Well, the reason being when it's a bunch sprint, they say it's a 3 second rule. When it's a mountaintop finish, it's a 1 second rule. It came in 2018. I only learned that in this race. I didn't know about that. But yeah, as you go along, you learn. So, I think the problem was the way they changed it at, you know, the last moment, if it was after the stage finishing, I'm not sure exactly, but, you know, it should have been out there. It should be put into the communique, which is the result sheets every team gets at night time after the stage have finished. And just, you know, if there were a change, at least give it to the teams there where the director sportives can relay it. And, you know, the riders were very unhappy, and rightly so.
Jonathan Vorster's EF Education First's team principal has been quite outspoken about this too. Let's hear from him now with Orla Shenouy.
So, Jonathan, congratulations. I'm guessing you're a pretty happy team boss right now. Hugh's been right up there on GC since the beginning of the Vuelta. What was the plan for today, can you tell us?
Well, I mean, with that climb... you know, tactics are a little bit out the window. I mean, it's just so steep. It's purely based on legs. There's no draft. So you really don't, you know, teamwork or whatever else is kind of useless, at least in the last, you know, 30 minutes of the race. Up to that point, you know, the tactic was just to stay around Hugh as much as possible. And, you know, keep him fed and keep him out of the wind. And, you know, Julius Vandenberg did a really good job of getting out in the breakaway, but that wasn't, you know, that was not with the thought of winning the stage. That was the thought of getting Julius out there just so that, you know, as he's coming backwards, if Hugh needs a bottle or Hugh needs, you know, a wheel or a bike or whatever, that like Julius is sort of like a, you know, rolling feeding station. And then, you know, Mike Woods stay with Hugh as long as possible on the climb, but end of the day, on a day like today, it's legs. It's not about a genius plan. It's just about pure legs.
And we could see on Hugh's face just how much pain those legs were in, his entire body was in. It must be pretty special for you, is it, watching all of that from afar?
Yeah, I mean, he proved his ability as a true fighter today, because you could see when it got up to, like, you know, 23-24%, the really, really steep pitches, you know, he was in a little bit of trouble. But then as soon as it backed off, and I mean, which is ironic saying backed off, because what was it backing off to, you know, 15% or whatever, 18%. As soon as it backed off, he was quickly right back on it and seemed to recover a lot faster than the other guys did as soon as the gradient came down. And so then he was, you know, straight into the attack. So his attack was really well timed. Just based on pure grit, you know, he definitely, you know, if you looked at his face, I mean, there were quite a few other guys in that lead group that looked better than he did, but, you know, he just won that on guts.
And Jonathan, Hugh was one of the riders to lose time on stage 10 when we had this very late change in the rules over the time gaps at the finish line. Do you take some consolation, though, from the seeming unity that we saw in the peloton in opposition to those rule changes? That's quite empowering, I guess, from the inside, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen in this Vuelta, it seems like the riders have been pretty unified in their approach a couple of times. and that's good to see. You know, I hope we get to the point where we aren't going to have to be doing protests anymore, that actually the commissars, the UCI, and the race organizers start listening to the riders in advance of the race, so that we don't have to have these, you know, protests and altercations and, you know, writing letters and all this other stuff that seems to upset them. You know, it'll be good if we get to the point where the riders union is able to really have a voice in, you know, in the design of these courses and in the way the rules are executed. You know, because they were right. I mean, the riders were right on that day. That was, the commissars just decided to, you know, to sort of redo the rules at their whim. And that is all too consistent of a theme with the UCI, is that they just like to do things their way when they want to. And I think it's good that the riders call them out on it.
Jonathan, he can have a decent time trial on his day, can't he? I mean, he was top 10 at the Giro last year, and he has some solid results behind him. What can we expect from him in this time trial? And has he done any specific work for this?
Actually, he's done a lot of specific work in time trialing, and he's a very underrated TT rider. You know, if it's a short, pan-flat time trial with a bunch of corners, then maybe, you know, that's not quite right for him, a little too explosive. But this time trial, you know, being 34 kilometers long and finishing on a quite steep gradient, I think will actually suit his capabilities to a T. So I give him better chances than most people do. He's a very underrated time trial rider. And I think the two top guys have a little bit more to worry about than they might know.
Because we've seen vulnerabilities as well from the two top guys, from all the top guys. They were all suffering on the Angleroo. We have one more mountain stage to come in which significant time could be made. What are Hugh's chances overall in this race at this stage, do you think?
Well, you know, the time trial is going to totally depend on who recovers the best over the rest day. I mean, you know, I wish that Hugh wasn't 35 seconds down right now. As I look at a lot of those 35 seconds, and I would chalk it up to that he's just never been in this position before in his career, so it was all a little bit new for him. And, you know, I think, you know, as far as pure strength, he deserves to maybe be only, you know, 15 or 20 seconds down at this point, not 35. So I think he's going to recover really well, or for the time trial on Tuesday. I think Roglic shows signs of cracking. He's had a long season, and historically he always fades in the final week of Grand Tours, and we've seen that. So I think even though on paper Roglic is the best time trial rider for Tuesday, if his recovery is bad and he's a little bit tired, which seemed to be the case in both cases, you know, he might not be as good as we're anticipating on Tuesday. Carapaz is a little bit of a wild card for me. I don't quite know how well he's going to go in the TT. I think he'll be recovered, but he's less of a good time trial rider on paper. Dan Martin, I don't really view as much of a factor at all. So I am cautiously optimistic that Hugh could pull off something really special in the time trial, and then, you know, and then we'll see from there.
We will see from there. You've clearly been looking ahead after the time trial as well. Will we see Hugh on the podium in Madrid? I know so many variables are involved in that prediction, and so many things can go wrong, but if all things are equal and if things were as they should be in racing, would we see him on the podium?
Well, you know, I don't like to jinx anything, so I'm not going to predict. I'm not going to predict much, you know, because there are so many things that can go wrong in a bike race. Obviously, flat tires, crashes, illnesses, etc. But I think, you know, I think we, and I think Hugh, more importantly, in the back of his head, is maybe aiming for something a little bit more special than just a podium.
And in anticipation of that possibility, Jonathan, I need to ask you, Hugh is a man of very few words when it comes to his interactions with the media. He doesn't have a social media presence. What kind of a presence does he have amongst the team? What kind of a team member is he? What kind of a person is he?
Oh, I mean, he's hilarious. I mean, he's actually a true persona. He has a very, very big personality. He just isn't interested in publicizing it. But amongst his teammates and, you know, amongst the staff of the team and the coaches and directors, he's not only very respected, but he's very, very well liked. He kind of, in a funny way, but less of a showman way, he reminds me of a young Rigoberto Urán. He's a leader. He doesn't even know it yet because he's really never had to lead a group of people. But he is a born leader in that he does know how to just stand up and get it done. He does know how to lead by example. He has a natural charisma that people, they want to help him. They want to help him succeed. You know, he's a very emotional personality, and we've had to work a lot on that. He goes up and he goes down, and he's got highs and lows, and that's something that you constantly have to work on with Hugh. But end of the day, he is somebody that people want to help win. And I think in cycling, there's sort of two types of leaders: those that like force you to help them win. They're just a, you know, sort of a big alpha personality that forces leadership. And then there's guys like Rigo, like I just said, who are such a charismatic and great person that people want them to lead. People want them to win. And with Hugh, he's not a forceful personality. He's not an alpha male. But all of his teammates, I guarantee you that whole team, they want to see him win. They'll turn themselves inside out to help him do something special.
Well, we're enjoying watching that, Jonathan. Best of luck for the rest of the race. Thank you.
Brad, JV, he'll be a happier man after today's stage. We've made it into, well, the most almighty of mountains at the Vuelta, the Ongleroo, a mountain that you're familiar with, of course. We'll come to that. First of all, set today's stage up for us. 109 kilometres, a short one. Three Category 1 climbs, two Category 3 climbs, a lumpy stage before the fearsome finish of the Ongleroo. One by
Hugh Carthy.
And the most almighty performance from him on the steepest, most fearsome of climbs.
Yeah, I mean, he's come of age. He's threatened this for a long time. Hugh's either off the front or off the back. He's not afraid to attack. I love his mindset. I love his character. I love him as a person. He's not fazed by anyone. He's not fazed by any climb. He'll have an attack. The next day he'll be dropped. He's not demoralised from when he gets dropped. And he just goes out there to race. He's got his reward today. He saw what it meant to him at the finish. And I hope this sort of is a catalyst for him riding a bit more sensible, which I don't know if that will take away from the entertainment he gives us.
Mm.
Because he's capable of winning this race now. He's now third on GC. Yes, there's a time trial to come. But He's in a position. I mean, he can definitely get on the podium. And to think Tao won the Giro, when I sort of think a G done the Tour, we could have had three British riders on the podium in each Grand Tour this year. I mean, when you think back to the start of Team Sky, you kind of forget how good we are as a nation now, really. And, you know, with Ireland as well, with Sam, you know, being the best sprinter in the world now, it's that whole generation change, you know, from sort of Kelly and Roach. And for my generation, watching Miller and Yates, you know, when Sean took yellow in the Tour in 94 for one day, you know, that, and Boardman won the prologue, that was like the best thing since Tommy Simpson. And but now it's like a regular thing. We're just it shows the change, the shift in cycling being anyone can compete, whether you're from the UK and Ireland and places like that, rather than you don't have to be Italian or Spanish or French and that cultured. We're now quite a... And for Hugh to get up there, he's got a week to go, you know. The worry is the time trial, but his strength today, if he can just adapt that. As JV said in that interview, he's not as bad a time trialist as you think.
Mm.
The podium has to be a goal for him now. He might have to ride a bit cleverer as well. But at the same time, he needs to probably still ride attackingly. The reason he's so entertaining is when he does attack, you worry that he's gone too early or he's risking something, because if he gets caught, he could get dropped. But that's why he's such a good rider, and that's why I love watching him. But to win a Grand Tour, he's going to have to ride a little bit more clever and need a bit more support around him. But I hope he believes he can win this race now.
I mean, surely he will. Sean, I want to get into that final 3 kilometres with you. Before we do, here's how Carlton Kirby called the last couple of 100 metres for us and Hugh's heroics on Eurosport.
Absolutely remarkable. Hugh Carthy has skiffled off, and I think he may well reach the line first. What a day. What a rider. And what a demeanour he has, both on and off the bike. Steady as she goes for Hugh Carthy. He's going to sail this one home, and I couldn't be more pleased for him. A man we used to describe as the Lancashire long shot. Well, right now he's a Lancashire hot pot, and he's boiling over. This is brilliant. Well, let's cheer Hugh Carthy home, shall we? 200 metres to go. He could almost freewheel it from this point. Absolutely magnificent. You couldn't be happier. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy. And it looks like he's already getting the roar ready. This is fabulous. Hugh the Mighty hits the line first, and the clock starts to tick back, and every second counts for him. It's 10 seconds, plus everything else he may have lost yesterday, and he's refinding that right now. What a brilliant ride by him. Dan Martin on the coattails here, but a fabulous ride. Vlasov, then Mass, overcomes Carapaz at the 18-second marker. So let's start counting that back. He's going to be in the red jersey, the red skin suit. Not so bad, not so bad. What is it, 8 or 10 seconds by the end, the gap between them. And Hugh Carthy has just stood up next to this mountain and chopped it down. What about that? I could not be happier for him.
So, Sean, Hugh Carthy's first Grand Tour stage win, his 5th win as a pro. That attack that we saw from him in the last couple of kilometres, awesomely impressive.
Yes, well, very impressive. And I think, tactically, he played it well. He allowed, Enric Mas, he attacked with 4 kilometres to go. And then we see the Jumbo Visma Kuss, he kept quite a good pace to just keep the gap to the minimum. And then it came back together, and there was a little bit of movement from different riders. But Hugh Carthy, when he hit out, it was just the right time. But he had the legs also, because with that fearsome climb, we could see the way everybody was just fighting with their bikes to get up it. And he's shown that in this Vuelta. I think he has the best form, I think, of his career, and now he's in a position to go for a podium place. The time trial is going to be a difficult one for him. He's going to really have to put in a good time trial, but after the time trial, it's not over. There's still a week almost of racing to go. As Brad said, will this change him? As long as he's riding for a GC, it does change you, because you cannot attack and then just get dropped out of the leading group. You have to be more, as I call it, you have to make the calculation more. And that's what he's going to have to do in this race. And I think, whatever the outcome of this race, now it will change him as well, because he knows he can get onto a podium in a big 3-week tour, depending on what sort of route is in the Vuelta, or if it's the Tour of France or whatever, with time trials and all of that. This will give him a lot more confidence than he ever had before.
Brad, that final 3 kilometres, it turned into an amazing sort of slow-motion bike race, didn't it?
Well, it is up the angle because it's so steep. It always is. It's a grind, and the strongest comes out on top up there. There is no luck.
Which is what JV said in his interview afterwards as well. He said it tactics go out the window. It just comes, it's such a steep gradient. It gets up to what, 23.5%?
Yeah, and you only have to push yourself a little bit too far and go into the red a bit too far, and you pay for it because there's no respite. We saw Enrico Mas do that. We saw Roglic drop Carapaz at one stage, but you can come back on a climb like that because it is just a grind. You can't really get in a rhythm. You can only get in a rhythm of grinding. And when it's like that, it shows the weaknesses. If you start to suffer, you can't drift and just sort of recover a bit, because you're always having to push, it's very talky. So
I thought it might suit Dan Martin today, that final climb, Sean, but we saw him suffer more than most, maybe.
Yes, well, he was suffering. We could see there, the face he was pulling. And if you're just not at your if you're not on your super day, well, then you're going to suffer. And I think everybody was suffering there today. And it's a matter of, you know, having that little bit more. And when you've got that, you can suffer that bit more. And, you know, that just that little bit extra, you can just, yeah, pull away and ride away in the end. And the Angaroo, you know, we talked about in our commentary, it's not a climb where you need a team mate around you. But with Primoz Roglic, I think Seb Kuss was important because, you know, he waited back for him. Then he pushed it on a bit and Roglic was losing the wheel again, a boy two lengths, and then he slowed it up again. And I think motivation-wise as well, Seb Kuss was probably telling him, come on, you can do it, come on, hang in there. You know, that helps you as well. And then the final bit as well, Roglic lost very little time. I think Kuss was important there because if you have somebody to pull you in that run downhill pretty much the line, you know, you can gain back a couple of seconds. So it was important today that Roglic had Seb Kuss with him. But normally that's a climb where everybody is just fighting to get uppers and, just the strongest and the fittest just come out in the end.
We saw Seb Kuss drop back for Roglic a few times and sort of pull over to the side of the road almost. If he was allowed to go today, could he have won it?
Well, I mean, it's difficult. You know, sometimes you go better and you ride stronger and you get more motivation for riding for other people. Once you're given that mantle as the leader, the mental side comes into it. But we saw it in the Tour de France on that steep climb where we thought he could have gone. I mean, he waited for Roglic when Lopez won the stage. Mm. And Sepp Kuss has said already in interviews that he doesn't ever see himself as a leader. And some riders just ride out of themselves. Richie Porte was very similar. You know, every time he got given that mantle in the Tour, obviously he made it this year. But it's a different feeling, I mean, to wait to explode your effort and sitting on guys like that. And Sepp, you know, he's so selfless as well. But so it shows it's not his first thought is to try and win for himself, that he's always looking for his leader. But that's the faith he has in Primoz, you know. Mm. Even though Primoz has showed cracks in this race, Jumbo still take it up. And they're not the dominant Jumbo that we saw at the Tour. They've shown weaknesses, but they're still committed to their leader, and that's testament to Primoz.
Kuss came in 26 seconds down with Roglic in the end. Sean, what do you think here? Because we saw so many riders today sort of pulling every sort of face you can possibly imagine. Kuss, again, just looking just as comfortable as he did in the high mountains at the Tour, no?
Yes. Well, I think he is, again, you know, so important to Primoz Roglic in this race. And, you know, the team, it's been pretty much excellent in this race. You know, there's days where maybe one of the riders have a bit of an off day, but there's always another one to replace him. And when you see today the way they were, you know, preparing the earlier part of the run-up to the Angaroo, you know, you had Gissing was there. Then you had the young Danish rider who set a pace.
Vingegaard.
Like, yes, they're just, you know, they're just still a super team. And when you compare with Ineos Grenadiers, like they're way, way ahead team-wise compared to Ineos have been in this Vuelta.
Carthy taking the stage win then. Alexander Vlasov coming in 16 seconds behind him. Enric Mas with Vlasov. Carapaz also at 16 seconds. So he's put 10 seconds into Roglic, meaning Carapaz is now in red. Brad with Roglic, 10 seconds. Hugh Carthy, 32 seconds. Dan Martin, 35. And then there's quite a jump to Enric Mas in fifth at 1 minute and 50. Who do you think this suits the most going into tomorrow's time trial? I mean, it's got to be Roglic, knowing just
yeah,
how...
Yeah, of course, Roglic, yeah. But, you know, he's not as dominant as he has been in other races. So although he may win the time trial, you've still got to have the legs. And, you know, we saw that at the Tour de France. You know, he can have off days. He might only win by 15 seconds. There's no guarantee he's going to win by a minute or 2 minutes because time trialing at the end of the day, you've still got to have the legs. Mm. And he showed that he's not on the sort of form we saw him earlier in the year where he was sort of invincible. He's coming off his best form, but he's limiting his loss as well. And he's mentally accepting that he can lose time some days and gain in others. He might just scrape over the line and win this Vuelta. I think he probably will. But that's why he's such a good rider, because he's not mentally phased if he loses time double. It doesn't demoralise him. He just comes back stronger. And I think it's more a case, he'll do his time trial, I'm sure he'll win it, but it's more a case of the how the performances of Carapaz and Hugh Carthy, whether they lose a packet or they just limit their losses to within 30 seconds, which is very possible, and taking advantage of Roglic not being on his invincible form. And then they stand a chance of challenging him in the last week.
Yeah. So I said there, the time trial is tomorrow. Of course, tomorrow is a rest day. And in a way, it might suit Roglic not to have the leader's jersey tomorrow. He doesn't have to worry about the press conference. He can just focus
on... Well, yeah, I don't think it phases him, that sort of stuff. But he's going to be behind Hugh Carthy. So he's got a carrot to chase. Carapaz is obviously going to be behind him. I think it's probably well stationed, really. I think... it's probably 2 minutes the last few riders off in the time trial. So Primoz on a good day, you know, if he catches Hugh, that could be quite demoralising. But if he doesn't catch Hugh and he doesn't see him, then that could be demoralising for Roglic because, you know, he realises he's not on a good day, you know.
Short climb to finish the time trial on Tuesday, Sean. Do you see that making a big difference on GC? And if not, which, I mean, we're running out of stages here, surely. We've got one more mountain stage. First of all, which one are you looking forward to the most? And second of all, which one do you think is going to make the difference?
Well, I think the time trial is going to be a good one for Roglic. I think he's going to put time into the rest. I would love to see it real tight at the top of the standings after the time trial, because then we would have a battle on our hands for the final week. And, you know, there is some difficult stages in the final week, but I think... Roglic, in the time trial, he's going to take a lot of time out of Carapaz. When you look at, you know, past time trials, the Giro last year, I was looking at it, and he seemed to take quite a chunk of time from Carapaz. As Brad said...
We thought that at the Tour, though, didn't we?
Well, we did at the Tour, but again, I think, you know, the man who beat him at the Tour to win the Tour de France, I think he was on one of these super, super days. And Primoz Roglic was just a little bit off his best. Unless there's a change in his form, which is highly, highly unlikely now with the rest day, because he's looking so good there today. I know he was suffering a bit on the climb to Angliru, but I feel that Roglic is going to dominate the time trial. And it's concerning times for the rest, because he's off behind Hugh Carthy, Dan Martin in front. He is going to put in a big time trial. And I would see Enric Mas also put in a real good time trial. He's a real solid time trial. He's consistent in time trials. So, you know, the battle for the podium places is going to be an interesting one. And, just let's hope that, they're not big differences after the time trial, because otherwise, you know, the race for the win could be over on Tuesday evening. But... it'd be nice to see a bit of a battle going into this final week.
You're talking about stage 9 from last year's Giro, and it was 2 minutes was the gap, nearly 1:55 that Roglic put into Richard Carapaz. Hugh Carthy came in 1:30 down. Going back to JV's comments, Brad, after today's race, saying that Hugh he's got better at his time trialing.
Yeah,
1:30 is a hell of a gap to make up though on a very, very similar course.
Yeah, it is, and it's probably a bit beyond him, we'd have to say. But you always have to keep believing, you know, and Teo proved that. It's just another stage, and he's got to do it as best as possible, because this race isn't over till the end, you know.
One other thing you've noticed this week is Roglic has been, when he's been warming down after his time trial, yeah.
And that shows he's concentrating on it, and maybe that stems from the Tour de France. He probably feels that he didn't spend enough time on his time trial bike before that time trial. Who knows, but it shows he's thinking about it, and he sees this time trial as pivotal.
What's the benefit of sitting on your time trial bike to warm down? I mean, presumably it's
just keeping on it, because you ride your road bike every day.
The familiarity of the position.
I'd have my time trial saddle higher, so your hamstrings are more stretched. It's just a completely different riding style. You spend so much time on your road bike that your muscles adapt to, you know, riding on the road bike. And we looked how much discomfort he was in at the Tour when he was in that last time trial. And maybe he saw that as not spending enough time on his time trial bike. And that's why he's addressing it now before this time trial. But he clearly sees this time trial as the stage to win the Giro, or the Vuelta, sorry.
Lacquer's collective cover is made especially for cyclists, for life on and off your bike. They've transformed traditional insurance to provide customers with a fairer, collective-driven approach.
say goodbye to fixed upfront premiums. Instead, your monthly contributions are based on the collective's claims that month. Your max monthly price is capped, but the savings are all yours. And they have some big news. LACA will be running its first ever crowdfunding campaign and offering equity for the pack. Cyclists have helped LACA bring a much better model of insurance to the masses, and that's why they want to invite you to join the ride. They're stoked to be able to give the Bradley Wiggins Show listeners the opportunity to own a part of LACA. You can invest in the future of LACA from as little as £10 and become a huge part of their collective. To register and find out more about LACA's crowdfunding, head to www.laca.co. Remember that when investing, your capital is at risk. This announcement was approved by Cedars.
Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggins Show in association with LACA Bicycle Insurance. Brad, we saw Dave B going back to the Giro talking about Ineos's tactics now, and that there'd be a far more attacking team, and they've got this new style about them, going for stage wins, not necessarily the same grind that we're so used to from Team Sky, sort of grinding other teams down on the high mountains. Are we seeing that yet in this race?
Probably not this race, although we've seen Chris Froome being really active, hurting himself, doing his job for his team. But it depends on the rider, doesn't it? Carapaz is an experienced rider. You know, he's won the Giro. It's not always necessarily, if they've got a rider in contention for GC, then it's not necessarily the right tactics to start attacking riders for stage wins. So that might be their mindset when they're out the race, like he did at the Tour. But you still have to see where you're at in contention for the race that's existing, because you need every man on deck when it's like that. So, but it shows that they're willing to have a change in philosophy if the circumstances are right.
You mentioned Chris Froome there. I mean, it's good to see him working hard on the climb yesterday, and we saw him on the penultimate climb off the front today, working for Richard Carapaz.
Yeah.
Are we expecting bigger things from him going into this last week?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I still think he's one big day in him where he's going to shine. He's getting back to the rider he was with every pedal rev. And he's shown that. He's every time he does a turn on the front, he's getting longer and longer into the race. He's enjoying putting people in the hurt bag again and regaining his confidence that he's, you know, a lot. You have to imagine for him, there probably was times where he thought, would I ever get back to that strength and that rider? With every rider that gets dropped when he's doing that on the front, he has to start believing, look, I can win races again.
Sean, for you, will he be refining that belief, Chris Froome? I mean, it must be very motivating when you're coming back from such an injury to feel that you are capable of riding on the front like we've seen in this past couple of days.
Certainly, you know, Froome in the earlier days of this Vuelta, he looked like he was struggling quite a lot, and he was losing contact. But, you know, we must not forget that he's been out of competition for a long time. And when you come back into a race like this Vuelta with the difficult stages from day one, it took him a little bit of time maybe to get into the rhythm, also experience. He didn't push himself too much in the earlier days, and slowly getting better. And he certainly is getting better, because we can see where he's riding now on difficult stages like today. And he's looking like that. He's a man, you know, with confidence now, and he's happy with, you know, the way he's riding. And that's so important for Chris Froome, because he needs this Vuelta, you know, to finish off the season, looking ahead to next year and looking further into this race, the final week. I can see that, you know, Carapaz will be in second position maybe in the race, and Chris Froome will get his opportunity maybe to have a go and try and get a stage victory. As Brad said, he's capable of doing it. He's done it before, and it's highly possible that we could see him in this last week of Vuelta.
That'd almost end up being the biggest headline of the Tour, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, Hugh Carthy winning might be, but just the fact that Chris is looking like he can be competitive again next year, which I think is what everyone wants to see, and challenge for a fifth Tour.
Chris has ridden for you on the Ongaroo, of course.
Yeah.
So I want to take you back to 2011, yeah. With you in red, Brad.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that stage, of that day?
I felt pretty good, actually. I remember not being able to get out of the saddle because I still had a broken collarbone. It was only 6 weeks since I broke it the Tour. And although it was strong enough to probably get out of the saddle, the nerves and that hadn't recovered. And I always was a bit cautious about getting out of the saddle. So I just had to grind up the thing. But those climbs never really suited me. And Kobo went off the front quite early.
And ended up winning the stage, of course. Yeah.
Me and Chris, I think, were just behind with Walt Powles, Denis Menchov. And I think I lost the jersey that day. That was where I sort of lost the race, really. But I never expected to be in that position going into that stage when I started the Vuelta. I was just doing the Vuelta much like Chris is this year, just to extend the winter, really, for the following year.
And the operation you'd had on your collarbone, you had it, what, a day after actually breaking it?
3 days after,
Three days afterwards. So did you think at the time it was too soon for you to even be... Well,
no,
certainly not.
I decided before I left the tour that I was going to do the Vuelta.
Right.
And 6 weeks in, they said I could be able to race again. And I started the Vuelta and I just still had good form, really, actually, yeah.
Can you remember what you were saying to each other on the climb?
Nothing.
Is it even possible to communicate?
No,
when you saw Sepp Kuss looking so comfortable.
You're just trying
today.
To get up the thing, really.
Yeah.
It's just a grind. Yeah.
No fans today on the climb.
No.
Which is a very different experience for you, though.
People were pushing us and stuff, and you know the Spanish fans are crazy. They support everyone.
Because the gradients are such, you're going that much slower, and therefore you might be able to take in that much more from the people around you.
The fans next to you can actually walk or run faster than you're riding, so they're with you a lot of the time up the climb.
Yeah.
And the hairpins are the flattest part, so you get recovery, and then it ramps. Yeah, it's really tough.
We sort of saw the 1,000-yard stairs after today's stage. What were you like after a climb like that? Or what were you like after the Hungary?
I actually can't remember, to be honest. I can't remember much about that day other than that. I just remember nibbly and that, like, all cracking. 1 minute riders are there, the next minute they're gone. It's like instant, you know? You don't get a sense where they're going to go. And people just run out of grinding them, you know? And it's more mental, I think. People just think, God, I can't do this, and they crack.
And were you aware of, obviously, what we know about Kobo now? Were there rumours at the time?
No. I mean, you're not thinking about that. You respect every rider. It was what it was. You're in the race in that moment. I mean, yeah, he'd been out for quite a while, but I think he'd had some psychological issues as well. We knew he was a good bike rider. I mean, but if you rode around every race thinking, wonder what they're doing just because they're better than you, you know, you don't think that.
Yeah, fair enough. Sean, what are your memories of your Vuelta win and particularly the climbs?
A lot of suffering.
I heard you say on commentary today, you've got to suffer like a dog, particularly on the Ongaroo, obviously.
Yes, on the Ongaroo, like everybody suffers there because of that gradient. And you know, as Brad said, when you're on a steep climb like that, which I didn't have in the time, I was riding the Vuelta, we had nothing of that gradient. But when you're going up at that pace, at such a steep gradient, the spectators, they just put their hand on their back. They're just standing there and they put their hand out and they give you a little bit of push forward. It's amazing how much of a help it can give you. But my experience on the big tours, on the Vuelta, when owners in 88, a lot of suffering in the climbs for me because I wasn't the best rider in the climbs and the steeper ones that we had, I definitely suffered a lot there. You just fight on and you get into your rhythm there on the climbs and you try and have a teammate around you and somebody to just keep that steady pace. If you're not one of those riders, can go with the sudden accelerations, the attacks of the better climbers.
Did it help you being in a Spanish team, do you think, in terms of the Mafia? Because when Robert Miller got done over with the Mafia, didn't he, there? And did being in a Spanish team at that time, did that help in terms of Spanish riders around you and your team kind of helping you get through that, talking to others? And
well, I think yes, the Spanish teams and the Spanish riders, I think they accept you a bit better when you're riding for a Spanish team. And also, of course, as you say, Brad, the spectators, like, they are crazy, and the spectators are very supportive when you're riding for a Spanish sponsor. And I was riding for CAS, which was a well-known sponsor, which had been there for so many years, going back a long time. So I had a lot of support from the spectators in the Vuelta, and also Pays Basque and all of those races.
What's more difficult, Sean, winning green at the Tour or winning the Vuelta?
Winning the Vuelta is much more difficult because to win the green jersey, you know, you can have a bit of an off day. You can lose a couple of minutes. It's not a problem at all because when you're going for general, you have to be there consistent every day. And if you're on an off day, you really have to dig deep and just, as I said earlier in our commentary, you have to suffer like a dog on those days and try and just limit your losses. So riding for the general classification in a big 3-week tour is the hardest thing you have to do. It's just the hardest trying to fight for the yellow jersey or the red jersey or fight for a place in the overall classification. That is the hardest thing in bike racing.
And one more on that. What's your most prized possession? Well, actually, because you had your green jersey pinched, didn't you, shortly
yellow,
after? Your yellow jersey pinched, sorry, shortly after the tour finished that year. If you had to choose between your Amarillo jersey or the Paris-Roubaix cobble?
I think the Amarillo jersey, because a three-week tour, you know, I had been working on that for many years, trying to get to the level where I could challenge to win a three-week tour, and eventually managed after many years trying in the Tour of France and in the Vuelta, of course, where with a cobble, well, I have two cobbles, so I could easily swap one.
I know what you'd swap it for, though. The Tour of Flanders, wouldn't you?
Well, yes, the Tour of Flanders, of course. You know, I was so many times close, three times third. And, you know, if you live in Belgium, and of course, the Tour of Flanders is, you know, such a monument. And in cycling terms, it's one of the ones that I miss on my palmarès.
And that world title in Sallanches. If you could run that 10 times, you'd have beat Le Mans 9, wouldn't you?
Well, yes, of course. Yeah. The World Championships, again, it's like a classic. You know, it's a race of 260 kilometres, and it's a race on a circuit, of course. So it's something like a Tour of Flanders, where you go around in one area, or a Paris-Roubaix. So, yeah, probably the Tour of Flanders is the biggest one I miss off of my career. But the World Championships, yes, it would be a close.
Coming back to this year's race, Primoz Roglic in pole position going into Tuesday's time trial. For the GC, if he doesn't win it, who wins this race overall?
I would have to say maybe Carapaz. I think it's wide open. I don't think this race is done yet.
If Carapaz can limit his losses and if he can make a difference on that
final
mountain
day. Yeah, we don't know how he's going to go. You know, he's a fighter. We saw him in the Tour. He's a fighter. He doesn't give up.
Sean?
If Roglic doesn't dominate the time trial, we will have a great race for the final week of this Vuelta, because I feel it will be quite close at the top of the overall standings between three or four riders. I can see Enric Mas moving up quite a bit, pulling back time, and the others, it could be a real fight for the final week, and it could go all the way down to the penultimate stage then.
Presumably you'd love to see Dan Martin do this though. I mean, I know me and Brad love to see Hugh do it from a British perspective.
Well, I think Dan deserves it more, because he's getting to the end of his career. Hugh Carthy, I think he has quite a number of years left. He's a younger, much younger rider. So for Dan Martin, you know, this is the opportunity to get on the podium of a three-week tour, and hopefully he can put in one of the best time trials of his career to, you know, to be still in after the time trial and then go into the final week and, either conserve it or be close enough where he can challenge to get back on the podium.
All right. Well, we look forward to seeing how that plays out. Brad, we'll be back next weekend.
We will.
For now, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport. Thank you, as ever, to our sponsor, Lacquer Bicycle Insurance. Sean, thank you for joining us.
A pleasure.
We can follow you on social media at...
Sean at Sean Kelly CC.
Lovely. Brad, as ever...
Sir Wigo.
You can follow Eurosport on Twitter at Eurosport_UK. Plus, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you too to our producer, Pete Burton. And finally from me, Graham Wilgos, it's goodbye. If you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, share your thoughts and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Sean, Brad, thank you to you both again.
Cheers.
We'll be back next week.
Yeah. Cheers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.